Yeah, leading up to the pandemic, I suppose I was kind of grimly monitoring the situation because, yeah, after the season we just had, it seemed like a bit of a cruel joke. So to put it in context, we just lived through five, you know, so-called once-in-a-lifetime events over the previous year. So we had storms, drought, bushfires, flood, and throw in a grasshopper plague for good measure.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Honeybees. Without them, we wouldn't be here. They are the world's most important pollinator of food crops. One third of the food we consume each day relies on pollination, mainly by bees. But with drought, bushfires, floods, and a pandemic, what has the impact been on bees and the purest of ingredients, honey? Tim Malfroy is one of Australia's best honey producers and owner of Malfroy's Gold. Tim, how are you going?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's been a pretty crazy period of time for all of us, but also producers in Australia that have had to deal with the elements leading up to the pandemic. Can you tell us what it's been like for you with the bushfires and the drought and the floods leading up to the pandemic?
Sure. Yeah, it was leading up to the pandemic, I suppose I was kind of grimly monitoring the situation because, yeah, after the season we just had, it seemed like a bit of a cruel joke. So to put it in context, we just lived through five, you know, so-called once-in-a-lifetime events over the previous year. So we had storms, drought, bushfires, flood, and throw in a grasshopper plague for good measure.
Wow.
So it's easy to rattle them off like that, but each one of those events was the most extreme version in recorded history. We also had a family illness with our newborn last year who was in and out of hospital for 4 months. So it's been, yeah, a roller coaster ride, and I hate roller coasters. So, yeah, we've been dealing with one thing after the other. And then the virus started overseas, and I think the first thing that we noticed was tourists stopped visiting the Blue Mountains. That's when we knew it was going to have a big impact on top of everything else we'd been dealing with. So that was probably around the end of January maybe, which is usually a pretty busy time for us in terms of honey sales. And the bushfires had already had such a big impact on visitation to the mountains. And the fires weren't really kind of officially contained. I mean, they weren't put out, they were just contained in mid-January. And then so it was really one thing after the other, well, rolling into the other, or they overlapped, because then the flooding kind of followed that. So we had them all happening all at once at one point.
What impact does it have on what you do?
Oh, well, there's kind of direct impacts in terms of the main fire in the Blue Mountains, the Gospers Mountain fire, which ended up becoming the largest fire ever recorded in Australia. That we were where that started out in the Wollamai Wilderness is right near some of our key apiaries. So we were kind of scrambling for maybe 12 weeks in total, just trying to move apiaries out of the fire front, working with RFS and property owners, and, you know, getting in there, raking apiaries, around apiaries, I should say, and relocating apiaries. Some of them we didn't get to in time. So then the fire moves through. We did have some losses, but because of the work that we'd put in, we managed to save pretty much everything. Some of them were saved, you know, by emergency backburns, and some were saved by water bombing aircraft. So it got pretty hairy there. I think just the scale of the fire and the length of the fire, like how long it burnt for, was kind of distressing. It went on for such a long time. And obviously you have the direct impacts of potentially losing, colonies and apiaries to the fire, but then there's indirect effects that follow it in terms of loss of forage for the bees. And the one that we noticed was just the most of our retail markets in the Blue Mountains, people visiting the mountains and buying the honey we produce. And that just disappeared overnight. And then following that was the virus, which really kind of had a huge impact. So it was kind of waves of waves of problems, I suppose. And the only thing that was really keeping us going after all that was the restaurant trade in Sydney, where most of our wild honeycomb is sold. So once that was shut down, we were down about 90% or something in February in terms of sales. So the only thing I will say is that honey never spoils. So we can sit on honey; it never goes off. So I really feel for the producers that have a perishable product. At least we're in the position where we can just leave the honey on the hives, which is what we've done a lot of at the end of this season, or anything that we've harvested can just be kept in storage. So
there is that benefit with honey, but financially, is that something that you wouldn't be able to do for a long period of time?
We run a fairly kind of low cost business. We don't have any employees. It's just myself, my wife Emma, and two children, and that's it. So we're able to kind of hunker down. It's winter now. We've got one more day of beekeeping, and then we're into winter, and we're just at home kind of doing winter work, which is melting beeswax and making beehives. We make our own hives from salvaged timber and bottling honey. So we can kind of just hunker down and get on with that work at home. And hopefully as things kind of open up again, looking at, September, October, then things will just gradually pick up from there. So, yeah, but things were going really well for us. So it has been a little bit shocking to kind of see after dealing with a whole season of problems kind of in the field, with the beekeeping, to have the market kind of shut down afterwards that was pretty difficult.
So you partake in natural beekeeping. Can you tell us what that is?
Sure. So natural beekeeping is a bit of an oxymoron, because as soon as you keep bees, you take that first step away from it being entirely natural, because it's important to understand that bees don't need humans. They're a wild species. They've been thriving for millions of years without humans. But what natural beekeeping aims to do is mimic how bees have done that for so long. My father's a professional beekeeper. I was raised in a bee shed. I've grown up around bees my whole life. But what I realized when I started my own honey label was that not so much with my father, who's very, very natural in how he does conventional beekeeping, but the rest of the industry was going pretty hard in a very kind of industrial kind of direction. So the needs of the bee colony and the wants of the beekeeper were drifting further and further apart. So I really wanted to come up with a style of apiculture that was more about the bees, the health of the bees. So we all know that, bees are in trouble around the world, but it's very rarely spoken about the type of hive that's used, the style of beekeeping that's practiced, as being a factor as to why that they're struggling kind of health-wise. So natural beekeeping is really based on five kind of core principles, which is letting the bees build all their own comb. All honey in Australia, apart from the stuff we produce, is produced on artificial comb or plastic comb. Letting the bees reproduce naturally or swarm. Natural food, so letting the bees just winter on their own stores. I mean, they collect nectar and pollen to turn into honey and bee bread, but they do that for themselves. That's their kind of perfect food. So we don't feed the bees anything. So it's kind of like zero inputs into the hive. no chemicals, so we don't use any chemicals at any stage of the process, and minimal intervention. So it's important to use a style of hive that mimics a tree hollow and mimics what bees do in nature, so that, you know, you have minimal intervention in the hive. You allow the bees to make all the decisions. They're better at making decisions than humans are.
So this natural process that you're talking about that you do to produce the honey, what is the resulting product of your work? How does it differ to other types of honey?
Yeah, so it's we have a few different types of products. The one that we were supplying mostly into the restaurants in Sydney is wild honeycomb. So people ask, like, why is it wild honeycomb? What's the difference? The short answer is that wild honeycomb or wild honey has to come from wild bees. So we don't breed bees. The bees are actually collected from wild swarms in the Blue Mountains. And then the apiaries are located in a wild environment. We don't move the apiaries. They're located in one place to produce like a terroir honey. And then they have to be in a wild type hive. And that usually means a natural comb hive. So the wild honeycomb is produced entirely by the bees from scratch. We don't give the bees anything other than the little wooden sections to produce the honeycomb on a particular honey flow, which is a flowering event that may last, you know, weeks or months. And it's got a very pure flavor. It's very delicate texture. And the other product we produce that's gained a little bit of attention is the post-brood honey, which can only be produced from the Warri hives that we use, and that is aged in the hive for about 4 to 5 years. So most honey is produced in a kind of 3 or 4 week window, I suppose, but this honey is part of the nadiring process that's unique to Warri beekeeping, and it comes up through the brood nest, so it takes on the essence of the bee colony as well as the surrounding environment. So that honey is actually doesn't taste like normal honey. It's quite a different product. It's very kind of rich, resinous, complex honey. It's got high medicinal activity. And, part of that comes from the aging process as it comes through the hive. Part of it comes from the environment where the apiary is located.
Do you choose the location of the hives, or do the bees choose it for you?
That's a good question. No, we do choose the locations because we need to be able to access the locations. We only use a ute, like a four-wheel drive ute, so I can access really isolated locations in the Blue Mountains. They're all on, you know, dirt tracks and hard to get to. So we pick places that, I mean, I grew up in the area, so I know the area well, and part of being a professional apiarist is you really need to know the flora of the area, you know, what things are flowering at what times, what causes them to flower, the different climatic events that cause certain things to flower, the budding cycles. And that's kind of challenging because in the Blue Mountains there's over 100 species of just eucalypt trees, let alone all the understory and other things that are flowering. So we pick different areas for different reasons. So we have apiaries in the lower Blue Mountains and the upper Blue Mountains, which is quite different, and then in the central Tablelands where we produce the yellow box and red stringy bark in the kind of vast high country woodlands out here. So they all produce or result in very distinct kind of different honey varieties.
What is it that makes good honey?
Well, if you're kind of entering honey into shows and things like that, there's kind of a judging, you know, regime you have to go along with. But we don't enter them anymore because our honey doesn't fit into any of the criteria. So because it's just too different. So I think good honey has to. I mean, honey's perfect in the hive. I mean, it's a perfect food. The bees make it perfectly. So the less you do to it, the better it is. I mean, honey is only degraded you know, from as you take it out of the hive and start processing it. So part of our job is to do as little as possible. So that's why the wild honeycomb is so satisfying, because there's really no human hands have really been involved in producing it. It's produced entirely by the bees. And we just remove the wooden frames and send them straight to Sydney to the restaurant. So I think that's part of it. The purity is really part of it. In terms of quality, then I think producing a honey that is produced in a hot, dry climate is very good for quality. So you have a nice, thick honey that's concentrated and full of flavour and aroma. So we certainly have hot and dry here. So Australian honey is very high quality.
With all of these natural events happening, like floods and bushfires and the drought, you know, what has been the impact on bees and how important are they?
Yeah, so the impact, I think the impact is everything that happens inside a hive is a reflection of what's happening outside the hive. So that means that things like drought, I know out here in the Central Tablelands, drought got so bad here that woodlands were just dying. I mean, I hadn't seen it before here. They were just whole woodlands were dying in a matter of days, and they are regenerating now after some recent rain. But people used to comment to me that they thought that they'd been burnt in a bushfire, because that's what they looked like. They completely defoliated. So that places stress on the bees. Obviously, there's a lack of there's multiple stresses on the environment, which then leads to multiple stresses on the bees. And nutrition is everything to bee colonies. So as soon as nutrition gets poor, then the bees will start breaking down with pests and diseases. So part of what I'm doing with the natural beekeeping and using worry hives and permanent apiaries is try to build resilience into the bees, using the bees that are locally adapted to the area and can deal with these kind of, you know, long droughts and periods of difficulties. So, and that's actually worked out quite well for us, because in other areas the bees haven't been able to cope with those changes. In terms of their importance, I mean, all bees are hugely important. I know honeybees really do get the credit a lot of the time, but, you know, in Sydney there's like over 300 species of native bees. Most of them are solitary, although there is the tetragonula carbonaria bee, which is a social bee that's endemic to Sydney Basin. So there's a huge amount of work in the environment that's done by all types of bees, and those bees are coming under threat from everything from, you know, pesticides to urbanisation to the industrialisation of agriculture, along with all these, you know, climate change related events that are occurring more and more frequently. So I hope that answers your question. But yeah, I mean, they are important, and they are under stress. But the stress comes from, you know, we have a lot of people contacting us wanting to help the bees, but keeping bees is not really, you know, getting a hive and keeping bees is not that important, actually, in terms of helping the bees. I think where you buy your food and who you support in terms of the food supply chain and the type of farmers or producers that you're purchasing from, getting out there and planting trees and shrubs if you've got a garden, is far more important than actually having a hive yourself.
Now, we kind of know the importance for our own food industry of bees and the role that they play, but, you know, you've got a lot of workmates in the form of bees. You know, what do you find amazing about bees?
Well, I mean, there's so much. I could tell them. How long have we got?
As long as you want.
Don't ask a beekeeper about how much they love bees. I mean, you know, you'll never get them off the phone. I mean, it's, I suppose for me, it's something really humbling to work with honeybees. They're so resilient and so ancient. You're working with a super organism, so they're kind of endlessly fascinating to work with, particularly with the natural beekeeping that we do. You get to see that in kind of full flight, because you're letting them do what they've done for millions of years. So, yeah, I mean, every day is amazing. You get to see amazing things, and they're kind of, I don't know, they're the central thread of my life kind of from birth onwards. So it's not really work in the typical sense. And the other thing I will say is it's not just about the bees, even though that they're just amazing to work with. It's where the bees live. So it's getting to spend our lives in these beautiful wilderness locations in the Australian landscape is just so great. And the Australian landscape is so incredible and unique. And I think we as a country kind of take it for granted a lot of the time. So, yeah, I think those two things. And then, you know, at the end of that, a food arrives that's the culmination of the bees and the landscape together, like a snapshot of a flowering event that might not be repeated, you know. So bees gather nectar from millions of blossoms and, you know, magically transform it inside the colony into a medicinal food with amazing flavour that never spoils. So it's something to live for.
You know, it's getting a little bit colder. We're moving into winter. You know, what happens to the hives and the bees during this period?
Yeah, so we're in a cool climate like Canberra and the Central Tablelands, the bees go into a state of torpor. So it's kind of a little bit like hibernation. I mean, they're still flying. They fly above, let's say, 8 to 10 degrees if you've got wild bees. And so there will be a little bit of flight activity, but in cold climates, the queen stops laying, they go broodless. There's very little food in the environment for them, and the days are cold and short. So, they don't kind of put their energy into gathering food. They put their energy into conserving heat because they're not just a super organism, they're a warmth organism too. So they have to, they use the honey as their fuel source to keep warm over winter. So it's, in this part of the world, it's a fairly quiet time for bee work. Although in the lower Blue Mountains, you know, on the eastern side of the Blue Mountains, it's much warmer and the bees will kind of continue, you know, breeding and continuing on through the winter months. So, we'll start up again down there in August probably.
With all of these natural events and then the pandemic, you know, how have you felt through this period, and do you think you'll change what you do moving forward?
That's a good question. I've been thinking about that recently, and it seems strange to say this, but our model, kind of business model is, or beekeeping model really is as diverse and resilient as it can be. Purely because when we started in 2006, like I was reading kind of widely around the topic of climate change and the Tim Flannery books, Bill McKibben books, Clive Hamilton's Requiem for a Species, and so all these kind of things that have happened this season. You know, it's kind of been well understood and predicted what was coming, and just from our sense, we could see the weather patterns changing and the bush and flowering patterns responding in different ways to the changing climate. So in that sense, what we kind of planned for it had worked. I suppose the scale of the fires and the floods really took everyone by surprise this year. In terms of the pandemic, I don't know. I mean, that definitely wasn't in the beekeeping model, but that's something that, you know, I think the tourist areas that really rely on people kind of coming in and spending up big, and the Blue Mountains is one of those areas for sure, I think will kind of suffer pretty bad over the next kind of year or so. So that's something to kind of rethink, and hopefully there'll be some more, you know, visitors, you know, from Sydney and from local areas. If anything, hopefully, I don't know, that people will kind of put a bit more precedence on, you know, travelling around Australia when kind of restrictions lift and, you know, maybe even looking at supporting local businesses and producers rather than relying on, you know, imported stuff, which has been shown to be, you know, the supply chain and everything's been shown to be pretty flaky. So, I don't know, there's something I'm pretty passionate about, you know, like when you buy stuff from a local producer, the resilience is free, you know, the future resilience. So I hope that's something that comes out of it afterwards, that there's a bit of a push for those kind of initiatives.
Well, those restrictions are sort of starting to ease and, you know, at the beginning of June, people in New South Wales will be allowed to travel again and restaurants will be allowed to have more people in them still with social distancing. Do you think that's going to have a positive impact for you and what you do and the area you're in immediately?
No, I don't think immediately it will. I think it'll take a long time. I was speaking to an operator at Katoomba and they have already told me that they won't open till October. So I think I'm not sure whether that's the same with some restaurants. Maybe they're putting people on JobKeeper and just waiting till that finishes. And with visitors, there was an article the other day about, you know, people in the Blue Mountains being a little bit concerned about lots of people visiting. So I think the time has to be right for people to kind of come out in you know, quantity or whatever to the regional areas. So we're happy to just wait and see what happens. We don't need it to go back 0 to 100, you know, straight away. I think, you know, gradual reopening as people get used to it over time is probably wiser and, you know, maybe more beneficial in the long run, even though there's a lot of people hurting out there. But look, that's just my own opinion. Lots of people have different opinions on this, so.
So you got a very, very unique product and something that most people probably haven't experienced in regards to a honey experience anyway. How can people get your honey and see what it's like for themselves?
Well, we do have through the pandemic, we've had some great shops in Sydney that we've supplied for a long time that have been supporting us, and they've been doing a great job. So it's kind of only available in Sydney at the moment. Feather and Bone, I'll give a shout out. They've been absolutely amazing and done a great job supporting all their artisan producers. Iggy's Bread have the honey, and you know, and our distributor in Sydney, Two Providors, have done an amazing job, and they've been so good to work with. Otherwise, we do have an order form on the website that people can. We've always been able to supply people directly through Australia Post interstate. Often, people visit the Blue Mountains or Sydney and try the honey and want to get it when they go back home. So yeah, we can post to you as well.
What do you think are some of the positives to come out of this situation that we're all in?
I don't know. I mean, we're not out of it yet. I think it's every day it seems to be new information and goalposts keep changing. I know we're in a really lucky situation in Australia that things are restrictions are starting to ease a little bit. I don't know what I mentioned before about at least with the hospitality sector. I think if there's a return to, I don't know, like a deeper connection between the chefs and the producers, and it's more transparent in that sense, and that restaurants are, I don't know, keen to relay the stories of where they're sourcing their produce and be willing to kind of charge what they need to charge to make it a, you know, a good financial proposition. I think that's there's been kind of murmurings about more of that happening over the last kind of few weeks. And that's, I think that'll be a really positive thing because, I don't know, it's chefs and restaurants are kind of the link between society and food producers. We're in a fairly isolated area here and we're not always connected in that way. So, you know, at their best, I think only good things come from that relationship, and that's kind of a rare thing to find. So, like, restaurants that support regenerative farmers create a flow-on positive effect to humans and environments in rural areas. And, you know, the restaurants get benefit with the best, freshest produce, and they get to tell that story and educate their customers. And so if we can get rid of some of the greenwash that kind of invariably occurs on both sides of the coin and people are transparent and kind of develop those relationships more closely on the other side of this, I think that'll be really positive for everyone, for the customers and the restaurants and the producers. I'm not sure if that's answered your question, but yeah, I think that's it has been a little bit of a problem in Sydney, that disconnect with food. I think the Sydney bubble is kind of a real problem, and some of the chefs and restaurants have been doing a great job bursting that bubble, like leading up to what's happened. So if that just continues and gathers pace, then that will be a really good thing.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to experiencing your wild honeycomb in restaurants as they open up again. Mate, really appreciate you sharing some time with us and some fascinating knowledge on bees. I think we need to chat again down the line, actually. I need to find out more about what you do because it's bloody amazing. Thanks again, mate, and keep in touch.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Thanks for having me and thanks for having some producers on the show. I've really enjoyed the podcast. So, yeah, keep it up. Thanks again.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we share the stories of Australia's hospo community, suppliers and producers in search of hope during this pandemic. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.